let's get started. My name is David Mazenbring, and this session is entitled Buried Treasure, Steve Biko and the Fall of Apartheid. And in some ways, represents the frustration over the last several times I've taught at Holy of trying to do too much in one session. So I'm splitting it up a little bit. Today we'll look at Biko and his role and some of the history surrounding the whole ending of apartheid. And then tomorrow focus more on that aspect of his ideas that I think have continuing relevance everywhere and not just in South Africa. But as a way of exercising your brains in the direction that we might want to go a little bit this afternoon, let me start by just asking you, what do you think brought an end to apartheid? And the reason I ask that is that I've spent very significant periods in my life not sure how it could end. So convinced by the intransigence and seeming all-powerfulness of the system in place there. I lived there for 2 years in 76 and 77 and spent another decade as an advocate for change there. And there were many times in my life when I wasn't sure it could or would come to an end. So it's a real question for me. What do you think brought the changes? I mean, I know that racism isn't over anywhere, certainly not in South Africa. White privilege isn't over in South Africa, but significant changes took place with the election of majority rule elections in 1994. What changed to make that happen?
Well, the first thing that popped into my mind was frustration.
Frustration, and I mean, did something new happen that created frustration, or
no, just they were so frustrated over the way they were living?
All right. Yeah. When we paint some of the history, we'll talk about the impotence of a movement that was timed to coincide with the 300th anniversary of the arrival of whites in South Africa. What else? What do you think brought an end?
Desmond Tutu and his part in the church there, I think he was a powerful force.
He said
it
was
all the divestment and you know, economic sanctions.
Economic sanctions? Certainly those two comments go together, because when Tutu speaks in this country, he inevitably begins by thanking Americans for the role they played by implementing economic sanctions. And he credits that. I think he's a little too generous in his crediting, but his opinions count for a lot more than mine, so... Any other thoughts on what brought an end?
Well, and the sanctions probably came about by pressure from people that simply became more informed. There was a lot of advocacy in this country through the churches mostly.
You have more faith in American, the power of American information education than I do, but I ask for your opinions.
How about Biko's writings? Did they make any difference?
I don't think his writings did.
His exam.
Then I think it can make a lot of difference now.
I just think about, you know, like the actions of the MK and sort of the other organizations that through the end of the 70s and through the 80s started really the guerrilla warfare and sort of making it a really unstable country where the National Party had so many, just couldn't control it all.
The turning to armed resistance after many, many decades of nonviolent strategies. All right, well, let me, my opinions will become implicit as I share with you my own sense of the history of South Africa. Now, I'm gonna talk in detail about the history of black resistance to apartheid. But before I go there, I wanna begin by reminding ourselves that in about 1900, there was a war between English, the Anglo-Boer War. The English call it the South African War. The or the Boer War, the Afrikaners, well, Boer is a kind of derogatory name for the Afrikaners. The Afrikaners call it the war with the English. We can call it the Anglo-Boer War. And it occurred about 1900, I think 1898, there were a couple of different phases of it. But about 1900, the English, and particularly the English commercial interests, mining interests, consolidated power, political power in South Africa, outlawed the Afrikaner language. And Afrikaners began a movement of cultural pride, you could argue, and strategic organizing of their community, and worked systematically from 1900 till 1948 to regain control. I mean, regain control of some parts of South Africa and establish unified control of the whole of South Africa. This is not the time to go into the detail. If you get interested in the history of South Africa, there is, in the audio archives, a presentation I did 30 years ago this month, believe it or not, called The History and Peoples of South Africa. And it's still up there. You can get into the details before 1900. But I just want to note, for purposes of looking at the history of black resistance to apartheid in the last century, the significance of these days, that the English defeated defeated Afrikaners about 1900, and in 1948, the National Party came to power on a platform of apartheid. Represented apartness is the Afrikaner word literally translated. And apartheid in 1940, apartheid began in the churches in about 1860. And it took from 1860 to 1948 to spread to become the political order of the day. Afrikaners came to power in the elections, whites only elections of 1948, on a platform promising to implement apartheid in the political sphere. But we should never forget that doctrine began in the churches. In 1911, an African intellectual, black intellectual in South Africa, wrote, "Forget all past differences among Africans and form a national organization." Now, that statement is pregnant with the reality that ethnic chauvinism is not confined to some areas that we know. I mean, it's rife in the world. And chauvinistic rivalry between Zulu-speaking black South Africans and Xhosa speakers and Tswana speakers is all over the place. So in 1911, there is this call for an all-African movement of resistance. And today, the ANC, the African National Congress, traces its beginnings to 1912. It was an elitist movement of African intellectuals who believed that in things like sending a deputation to London to appeal to the sense of English fairness and the Queen, to kind of get in front of English Parliament and explain to them how unjust were the things that were going on in South Africa and why change was needed. In 1913, you get the Land Act, which was a huge factor. Was it 1913? Yeah. A huge factor in forcing blacks from the farms and the rural areas into the towns and cities as bringing cheap labor into the white areas. And so the ANC and these educated African intellectuals, small membership organization, all men until 1930 when they accepted affiliate women members, and then in 1943 they actually allowed women to be full members. But initially it's a group of intellectual black men from various African language groups that are going to appeal to the sense of justice and fairness of the English, who were the ascendant rule power, that what was happening wasn't fair, dedicated to nonviolence. It's pretty dormant in the 20s and the 30s, and you can really argue that there's a stage from 1912 until about 1944 when the ANC is dedicated to that rather impotent strategy. 1944, the Young Turks come to power. Mandela, Nelson Mandela, Oliver Tambo, Walter Sisulu, and the Youth League, the ANC Youth League. It took 5 years for the ANC to actually embrace the Youth League and integrate it, but the Youth League cites its beginnings in 1944. And their strategy was less of elite intellectuals and more of mass demonstrations of popular resistance, civil disobedience, still committed to nonviolence. But they said the time of waiting for appealing to the better conscience of whites is over. We need to mobilize the masses.
Are the Afrikaners Dutch ancestry?
Yeah, Dutch, French, Huguenots, some German, but yes, a white tribe.
Not English, though.
No. No, there's two white, that talk that I did 30 years ago, we'll go into detail about the two white tribes of South Africa, the English speakers and the Afrikaner speakers. And they're in power. They come to political, the Afrikaners come to political power. Apartheid is their, is a word from their language. Afrikaners, from the Afrikaans language. More, it's closer to Dutch than anything else. There's more Dutch cultural influence than any other European stream. It's an indigenous, I consider it an African culture by now. I mean, it took root 300 years ago, so it's had plenty of time to root itself in Southern Africa. All right, so the Youth League comes to power, comes into existence in 1948. By 1949, it's taken into the ANC, and in 1952, you get the defiance campaigns. These are mass protests of non-cooperation with unjust laws. As soon as 48 happens, the Afrikaners start pushing apartheid legislation. Multiracial schools are banned in the early 1950s. And the Anglican Church, for example, which ran some very strong multiracial schools, some of the best schools in the country were multiracial. At that point, you either had to close the school or capitulate and make it whites only, or blacks only, but there wasn't much demand in the white community to do that. So the defiance campaigns are mass-organized campaigns that are trying to not cooperate with the law, and which result in major, large-scale police crackdown. And you really have the ramping up of a police state. The Youth League, under its leadership, thinks that if we just create massive resistance in the form of civil disobedience, we will make the efforts of the apartheid government unworkable. And in the defiance campaigns of 1952, there are like 10,000 protesters, but the government arrests and imprisons 8,500 of them. And the white community just says, well, we're going to have to answer this with force. And the early workings of police state power and organization in South Africa take place. 1955 is a critical date for the Congress of the People. And some of you will remember the Freedom Charter. How many heard of it? Yeah, during the late in the anti-apartheid movement, Freedom Charter was a document that would be lifted up as an example of the noble enterprise of the anti-apartheid movement. The Congress of the People meets, and the Freedom Charter is adopted, and controversy, this is really important to understand what happened with Biko's movement later, controversy begins to boil about the role of whites because the ANC, from its earliest stages right down to the present day, has been very consistently committed to a multiracial strategy. It would work with anybody who was against apartheid. And in the Defiance campaigns in the 50s, a white-led communist party is welcomed. There's colored people, you know, mixed race people's parties can come in. The party, political parties of the Indians, liberal white, liberal English-speaking political parties are allowed to participate in these campaigns. Now, there was and that fueled the debate among black South Africans. Are the liberal whites, English-speaking whites, just jealous that the Afrikaners are in control, or are they really our best friends, as they say they are? Anyway, there are these massive campaigns, big conferences, resistance. The frustration with the role of whites leads in 1959 to the founding of the Pan-Africanist Congress, which takes up the cry "Africa for the Africans," and is really a reaction to the multiracial strategy of the ANC, the African National Congress. And you now get an all-black organization that says, we cannot trust working with white liberals or communists or radicals or whatever they are to help us. We need to take charge. We are the majority in this country, and we need to take charge on them.
What's the ratio of blacks to whites at that point?
At that point, boy, that talk in 1979 would have the data, but do I still remember it? I used to know. I'm going to say 10%, 5-10% of the population is white.
Oh.
The demographics have changed a lot, and I am out of touch. So that's a, don't quote me on that, although it just got recorded, so. Yeah. 1960, the PAC gets ready to launch a new campaign of civil disobedience against the pass laws. Pass laws, one of the most hated forms of documentation and control of movement. We'll come back to it on Friday when we ask the question, is there apartheid in Israel today? The pass laws were a potent and very hated form of oppression being promulgated by the white government. And the Pan-Africanist Congress, with the ANC, announces a new campaign aimed at the pass laws. And so the PAC starts it 12 days earlier just to get the jump on the ANC. And on March 21st, 1960, when the PAC, at the PAC organized demonstrations in a place called Sharpeville, police opened fire on a nonviolent protest, killing 69, wounding 180 others. In Luanda, 1,000 kilometers away, the same thing happens, except the death toll and the injury toll is smaller. But police opened fire on two nonviolent protests organized by the PAC against what the PAC and the ANC both considered unjust laws on the same day. And people start to figure out that the government strategy of repression is getting more and more violent. And the armed struggles, Mkonte Wesizwe and Poko by the PAC, both those organizations, well, are banned. 60 is Sharpeville and Langa. Sharpeville massacre, it outrages the world. Lots of publicity. And then later that same year, ANC and PAC are both banned, made illegal. So by 1960, you've got an almost 50-year history of committed nonviolence. And it's totally ineffective and outlawed. Impossible. Which I remember in the 60s and 70s and 80s, when people talked about the ethics of using violence, you know, rarely did Americans who argued against the legitimacy of the violent enterprise know much about that history.
I'm wondering where America stood back then and on apartheid and whether they supported the white minority or the black majority, and when did America clearly, start opposing apartheid?
Well, we could have a good discussion about that and generate lots of difference of opinion. The Anti-Apartheid Act of 1986 represented a congressional move to implement some limited economic sanctions, 1986. Prior to that time, I think, my own view would be prior to that time, it was unbridled support. And following that time, there was still extensive support in terms of official government policy, military cooperation, et cetera. But the economic involvement by American investment on the private sector, not the government sector now, but on the private sector, just grew tremendously after 1948. Became very, the American business looked at the situation and considered that its prospects for profit were on the upswing. And so U.S. investment by private sector grew during the 1950s and 60s and 70s. It's another issue. All right. Reagan's policy was called constructive engagement.
Oh.
Reagan resisted the call for divestment. He resisted the growing calls for divestment in the early 80s by arguing that it was better to be constructively engaged and at the table with the government of South Africa than to alienate them through economic sanctions. But the sanctions bill passed and was implemented in 1986, and that's what Tutu now argues was a hugely helpful thing in bringing the government to the table. We should come back to that in a few minutes. All right. So armed struggle organizations are formed in 1961. Very quickly, Mandela and others are caught. Mandela was the chair of Umkhonto we Sizwe, Spear of the Nation, the military wing of the African National Congress. It actually was a coalition between the African National Congress and the South African Communist Party. They both formed this armed this movement. It was dedicated to, it tried to protect loss of life. It tried to avoid loss of life, but do the sabotage, the blow up a power line where nobody got killed. The PAC's organization, POCO, was a little less discriminating in terms of whether human life was involved. But both organizations get infiltrated fairly quickly by the South African government. The leadership is arrested. There's a famous Rivonia trial, and it takes a couple of years to go on. And by 63-64, Mandela is shipped off to Robben Island. Anybody know the date more precisely? I didn't. It's about then.
Yeah.
It's about then. So in 1961, Steve Biko's 15 years old, growing up in an urban township in South Africa. And following the arrests and trials by 62, you get this huge, I'm just going to call it quiet, mostly because I'm out of space and I don't want to get a backache there running over. After so Biko grows up at a time of growing urban demonstrations. It's got to be exciting to a 13, 14, 15-year-old kid, right? And then all of a sudden, it comes to a huge stop when the leaders are arrested and imprisoned, sent off to Robben Island. And throughout the 1960s, as he becomes 17, 18, 19 years old, nothing is happening politically in the country. He sets his mind on a good education, goes off to school, various boarding schools. His father died when he was young, But a white Anglican priest took an interest in the family and kind of helped him and his brother get into good schools. And by 1967, he's in medical school in Durban. And he starts participating in multiracial student organizations. Now, you had among the student organizations in South Africa, you've got Afrikaners. Then you've got NUSAS, National Union of South African Students, which is really English-led but multiracial, English-speaking white South Africans that, as part of their protest against apartheid, allowed a few elite blacks into the organization. And you also had University Christian Movement, UCM, which was, these two are both English plus a few blacks and coloreds and Indians and so forth. Biko gets very active here. I mean, there's no chance for him to be active over here. And he gets very active in these organizations. And increasingly, I've gone through the archives and read the letters of frustration between him and some of the white NUSAS leaders. And when you look at what he has to say in the book, it you begin to understand his frustration with white leadership. And these are some of the ideas that we'll be going into and looking at tomorrow. But the concept of black consciousness is born when Biko. Well, it was really there are people who think a crucial meeting occurred when the English would, the NUSAS organization would commit itself to meeting at a university where blacks and whites were going to be housed together. And at the last second, the university administration says, oh, cannot allow that. And the organization goes ahead with its meeting anyway and asks the blacks to meet, to sleep, in the black township. And I interviewed one guy once who argued that it was those long marches back and forth between the black township and the multiracial organization when the blacks caucused and said, you know what, these guys don't get it. They are not walking in our skins, and they are not as much our best friends as they claim to be. And Biko evolves a notion that there are two problems in the country, a problem of a white superiority complex and a problem of a black inferiority complex, and then until blacks go off and caucus, they're not going to be able to do anything about their inferiority complex. And if whites are really so worried about improving the situation of blacks, why don't they address the issue of white racism, which they're uniquely well positioned to do in the first place, instead of trying to do charity in the black townships. Sasso is born in 1968, South African Students Organization. All black. Who do you think is the most concerned? The English-speaking whites. And they immediately cry that this is racist and that blacks have fallen victim of apartheid ideology. And in the book, tomorrow we'll quote some sections where Biko addresses what is decried as an immoral, racist strategy for blacks to withdraw from the white liberal organizations and form their own all-black organization. He's 22 years old. By 1972, Sasso forms, and it begins to, it organizes, it spreads very quickly on the black university campuses. Now, the fact that the English-speaking, it's hard to underestimate the rivalry in South Africa between the English-speaking whites and the Afrikaans-speaking whites. But remember, they fought a war not that long ago. They really intensely dislike each other. And the very fact that the English-speaking whites were so offended by the formation of Sasso results in the Afrikaners assuming it must be a good thing and giving lots of organizing time. Secondly, blacks were already segregated. There were separate black universities scattered around the country. So a black students' organization was easy to organize on the black university campuses. And instead of a few of the most politically inclined and active blacks leaving black campuses and going off to white campuses for political meetings that were designed to talk about how we change the situation in the country, how we overcome apartheid, blacks just stopped going. And Biko started moving around the black universities and holding organizing meetings. And Sasso grows very quickly. He starts publishing a newsletter. He's immediately elected president of SASO in 1968. 1969, a year later, they have their conference. And people kind of say, well, Steve, obviously, you're doing a great job. You repeat as president, and he says no. And I'm convinced that the reason he refused to run for re-election as president of SASO was his fresh memory of what happened when a few leaders, Mandela, Sobukwe from the PAC, Sisulu, Oliver Tambo, when a few leaders are removed from the situation in 1960, the whole movement grinds to a halt. And Biko says, we don't need a few leaders. We need a lot of people, and we need a reconscientization of the whole gang. Today, the first black chancellor of the University of South Africa, one of the largest correspondence universities in the world, was the second SASO president, Barney Pichana. Biko becomes the publications chair of SASO. He was a voracious reader of many disciplines. Barney Pichana says that when Barney was an English major and Steve was a medical student, Steve could cite literary criticism to Pichana in a way that blew Pichana away. And it was his specialty and it wasn't Steve's, and that Steve had read in that field. He was also very gifted in communicating his ideas in a very accessible manner. And so he started writing, What is Black? He wrote under the pseudonym of Frank Talk. Not just to evade government oppression or censorship, but to keep the focus off of himself and on the ideas. And a column he wrote for the SASO newsletter was called I Write What I Like. So that's where the book, which is in the bookstore, gets its title. Steve Biko, I Write What I Like. It includes several columns from the SASO newsletters signed by Frank Talk. And he's expounding on the ideas of black consciousness that we'll look at tomorrow. Now, 68, SASO was born. 72, Black People's Convention is formed as a political one. This is a students' organization. Students grow up, they graduate. Steve gets expelled from medical school in 72 because he just was not spending any time on his studies whatsoever. Black People's Convention is formed in 72. 73, he's banned. When you're banned in South Africa at that time, it meant you couldn't be quoted in any publications. You couldn't meet with more than one person at a time. You were restricted to a given police district, so you had a very limited movement. He's sent to King Williamstown. His hometown, which was considered a political backwater. I'm going to just depart for a minute here and tell a story. Right after Steve's death, moving around and interviewing some people about him, I met and interviewed Griffiths Mkhwenge. Griffiths Mkhwenge was a few years later, just brutally murdered. But he was from King Williamstown, Steve's hometown. And in this period, he had been arrested and sent to Robben Island. But instead of getting a life sentence like Mandela, Mkhwenge got a sentence of, 5 or 10 years, something like that. So he goes to Robben Island, and comes out and then goes to Durban and sets up a law practice and is contacted by Biko at one point, who he had never met. But Biko and Mklinge come from the same small town. Now, Mklinge told me that on Robben Island, King was referred to, King Williamstown, was referred to in a, it was kind of the symbol of the most back, politically backward part of the country. So if you wanted to refer to, I used to use an example here. How would it play in Peoria? That's not really a pejorative connotation.
Where is it located?
King Williamstown is in the Eastern Cape, between Near East London, Port Elizabeth, Xhosa speaking region. It was a political backwater, and on Robben Island, among the politically conscious blacks, King Williamstown had the pejorative connotation of being just where blacks were, where you would never get liberated thinking. So Biko is restricted there because it was considered a safe place to send him by the police, and it was where he was born and raised, so it had logic in their minds. Black community programs gets formed there. I mean, Biko takes BCP. Black community programs would set up a Mzanampilo Medical Clinic. Black design, black run, black staff, black built medical program in the rural backwater of South Africa to show black people that they don't need white doctors to get good health care. What a concept, right? And Zampilo Trust is set up to help, well, that came in 75, but out of, from Biko's base in King Williamstown, all these black self-help programs start to take root and grow. And at one point, there was a political trial. I forget what the issue was, but somebody had stood up to the police on something. And so the local government was making an example out of it, and they'd bring it to trial. And Biko contacts Mklinge and says, I want you to be the lawyer. I want you to come, and you know, we're not going to pay you, but you need to come. You need to come home. We haven't seen you in a while. So Mklinge, you know, he's served his time on Robben Island as a political prisoner. He's free. He's a lawyer in Durban. He goes back home to King Williamstown, and he says he cannot believe how the place had changed. That the courtroom was filled with black people who were expressing themselves in a very noisy manner. And he said this would have never happened the last time he had been in King Williamstown. And that's when Biko got his attention, that the consciousness that we are human beings who cannot be violated, whose basic humanity has to be respected. He had seen the way in which it was working at the grassroots among people there. Similarly, in 1976, a year or two earlier, maybe in about 74, there's a Southern Africa, you have South Africa here, and you have Mozambique here, Namibia here, Angola. So in the early 70s, Angola and Mozambique were Portuguese colonies, and there were wars being fought against the Portuguese there. And in about 74, Black People's Convention organizes a demonstration in support of Frelimo, the black liberation movement fighting against Portuguese control in Mozambique, for which the leadership of Black People's Convention is arrested and put on trial. In 1976, the Sasso BPC trial occurs in Pretoria. Steve was curiously not charged, but many others were. And he is brought in as the defense witness. And a couple of the chapters in the book are edited transcripts of his testimony at the trial. which is just brilliant, for the way in which the Afrikaner judge and the prosecutor are both trying to make him guilty of black consciousness, and he, in how he's answering the questions, is putting the whole white apartheid system on the defensive. And the black papers in Soweto are covering it. And every night in the shebeens of Soweto during that trial, Biko is the toast of Soweto for the way in which he is speaking truth to power and foiling their efforts to, I mean, in the end, they did charge his friends and colleagues, and a number of them got 5-year prison sentences. But I think it's very significant that in May of 1976, Biko is being quoted as a banned individual. He could be quoted for his testimony at the trial, apparently, or at least the black newspapers in Soweto did it. The white newspapers in Joburg didn't, but the black newspapers in Soweto did. And in June of 1976, June 16th, 1976, today, June the 16th, is commemorated in South Africa as a holiday. It's Youth Day. And many of you are old enough to remember that it was on June 16th, 1976, that Soweto students were marching to the Board of Education to protest being forced to be schooled in Afrikaans. The two official languages in South Africa were English and Afrikaans. The Afrikaners had been so bitter about the way in which the English banned their language, but they didn't learn the lesson. Rulers rarely do. And so they were trying to force Afrikaans on the children of Soweto, and the children of Soweto were protesting against being forced to learn in Afrikaans, which they said is not our language. I argue that it was their own sense of dignity, fueled by the ideas of black consciousness, that caused them to revolt. And I was in the country in 76 and 77, and unlike any demonstrations that had ever occurred in the history of South Africa, when those students were murdered, black townships all over the country started igniting, and it went on for 6 months. They would get the fires put out in this one, and then it would break out over there. And I remember being in the country, and just day by day by day, I was teaching in an Anglican seminary in a remote backwater part of the country down here. Joburg is up there, and Cape Town is over here, and Durban is over here. And you would just watch the papers to see where it would start, where it would flare up or flare up again and be brutally repressed. But people kept coming back over and over and over again. And from 76 until through the late 80s, the place was never quiet. It just got hotter and hotter and hotter. Now, when I lived in South Africa, nobody could tell you when the ANC started. I mean, it was just that the political history of black resistance to white rule was unknown. Today in South Africa, virtually, I mean, the average people on the street know this history. ANC gloriously formed in 1912. They know about the Defiance campaigns in 52, the Youth League in 44. They can cite Sharpeville. There isn't much attention given to the PAC, which had various corruption problems and never had much time to organize in the first place. It went underground and outside of the country. The PAC and the ANC, when they went underground, the statement used to be they were so far underground, Biko would say, they were so far underground we can't find them. And in after June the 16th, Biko and a whole wide array of his colleagues in the Black Consciousness Movement are all put in detention, being held in police custody without trial from late June until early December. They're in detention, which was also the period when the reservations of South Africa, South Africa had set up this Bantustan reservation system, and declared that it was going to give blacks independence in their own areas. And the model one was to be the trans guy here, and he was to get his independence in October of 1976. And the BPC, Black People's Convention, had planned to organize major demonstrations around the country in protest against this this public relations campaign that the South African government was undertaking to declare that it had given democratic, that it was now a democracy. Black, everybody had the right to vote, they just had the right to vote in their own areas, and there was no central election. So partly you could say that the Black consciousness people are detained because whites have got to blame somebody for the uprising that occurred, and they didn't know who else was politically active and could be blamed, and partly because they wanted to keep the best, the most politically active blacks off the streets at a time when they were trying to do the stage this major public relations campaign for the world. Biko gets released from detention. Biko and others get released in December. In August of 77, August 18th, August of 77, Steve goes to Cape Town. Now he's banned, but he was famous for ignoring his banning order. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed. He argued that fear that the security police were always watching would cause self-censorship. Fear that they might catch me, you know, that the system could never comprehensively prevent all the activity it wanted to prevent, but it could create the fear that it might catch you. And so he was famous for ignoring his banning order and showing up in Kenya's, King Williamstown is down here, here's this big city of Port Elizabeth over here, and he'd show up in Port Elizabeth, it's maybe a two, three hour drive. He'd show up in Port Elizabeth, on the streets of Port Elizabeth, and be back in King Williamstown before the security police knew that he had left King Williamstown. And then he'd be the talk of Port Elizabeth and the black townships. Biko was here today. You know, he's banned, but they can't stop. Steve and another colleague went to Cape Town in August of 77 to plan an initiative that there were plans being made to get Steve out of the country and over to England to talk to the ANC and the PAC, who are living fat in Europe at this point, I mean the elite leadership is anyway, about how come the people are ready for revolution and those leading the armed struggle are nowhere to be found. Thousands of young children left after June the 16th, and there are all kinds of stories about what happened to them and how ill-prepared were the liberation movements to receive these people. Which is why, I think, when I went with my family in 2003, and the son of South Africa's best anthropologist, who is himself a really important labor economist at the University of Cape Town, told me that the 1970s are just, I commented on how people seem to know the political history of the country so much more than they used to. And he said, yes, but the 1970s are totally missing from the history books and from the historical consciousness of the country. Because what happened during the 70s, the ANC and the PAC can take no credit for. The ANC got very active in the mid-80s when it became, the whole thing deteriorated from 76 until 89. And you had open ANC, you had people openly identifying with the ANC by the early 80s and into the mid-80s. And the government just lost the ability to keep the ANC underground. So the ANC can legitimately claim credit for doing a lot in the 80s, but not the 70s. And I will try to make the case tomorrow in reading more from Beagle's book. Why he really implemented this and worked on a strategy designed to recover the consciousness of people who had, what was the phrase that Sunita used yesterday? The internalized oppression. Beagle and the Black Consciousness Movement addressed the internalized oppression of black people, their own belief that they were inferior. And when you overcome that, then you can shoot and detain and torture all the people you want, and the movement won't stop. And so he's on his way. He violates his banning order by going to Cape Town for this meeting to talk about leaving the country to have a meeting. He wasn't leaving the country indefinitely. They were going to slip him outside, get him over to a meeting where he was trying to bring together the ANC and the PAC and say, get your act together, guys. Stop fighting with each other. And it was on his way back to King Williamstown on the 18th of August that a roadblock set up by the police for a totally different purpose, not to catch him, but for a totally different purpose, nabs him, finds him, and then immediately imprisons him. And on the he's beaten badly. I don't know if it came out in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. I'm not sure how much of the story they got. But what we know is that he was severely beaten, had a brain hemorrhage. They had trouble at age 33. He was a very physically strong man. He refused to die. They threw him naked into the back of a pickup truck and drove him 1,000 kilometers, 650 miles, overnight with no medical attendant, nothing but a blanket and naked in the back of a truck. And finally, on the 12th of September, 1977, he became the 46th black South African to die in police custody with no charge against him. Because he had been visited by U.S. congressmen and journalists from Europe and the United States, his death became a huge international controversy and caused all kinds of poor publicity for South Africa, particularly when the Minister of Justice in South Africa, Jimmy Kruger, was quoted as saying that Biko's death leaves me cold. And the world got hot about it. Peter Gabriel wrote the song Biko. A film is made in the mid-80s, which would be worthy of more time than we have to talk about why it so depressed those who knew Biko best, but in true Hollywood fashion did gain a mass audience that is today probably the number one way most Americans who recognize the name Biko will be from that film. So it popularized him, but if you recall, he dies in the middle of the film. Why? I'm convinced that films have this chronology, and scripts get written, and then they get sold to investors, and they get adjusted. I think what happened on the film Beagle was Richard Attenborough. Remember, he does the film Gandhi, which is this huge success. His next film is about Beagle, and it's a flop. It's a total flop. Why? Because after the film was agreed upon, how they were going to do it, I mean, the Hollywood financiers said, we don't think the American public is ready for a black hero. So they decided to make the story about Donald Woods, Biko's good friend, and Donald Woods getting the story of Biko out. Woods published a book called Biko that should have been called Woods. And if you recall, how many have seen the film? You know what I'm talking about. Remember at the end of the film, Woods risks his life by crossing this raging river to get out of South Africa and to bring the story of Biko. The river that he crossed will come up to your knee in the rainy season, and he crossed it in the dry season. But Hollywood finance people didn't think Americans were ready for a film about a black leader. And they were right when they made the decision. But after they made that decision, and before the film came out, Trans Africa, a black lobby for Africa and the Caribbean, in Washington, D.C., under the direction of a guy named Randall Robinson, start getting arrested in front of the South African embassy. And all of a sudden, it became extremely popular all over the United States to seek out the local South African consulate office or business interest office or embassy and get arrested. Thousands of Americans got arrested. And it was all under leadership of an African-American lobby. And by the time the film actually comes out, the number one critique of it is that the number one critique of it is, well, the guy Biko looks pretty interesting, but he dies in the middle of the film, and mostly it's about this white guy Woods. That was, and the film was a flop.
Yeah, I heard that same thing. Does it mean that it's worth watching the first half and then you can just turn it off?
I'd watch it, but I'd watch for that lady doctor in the film, who is a prominent character, and then remember that that she told me she sought. She had to seek spiritual direction, and only in coming back to the church did she get over the depression she went into when she saw the film. So, you know, it's that old trade-off between what is accessible and draws us a little bit closer. The best thing to do is to read Steve's own writings, and that's what we'll be looking at tomorrow, and what I will end with. Almost on schedule right now by quoting one of my favorite passages, just as a teaser for tomorrow. It's a speech that he gave to a group of black clergy, and the editor of the book, Father Hillard Stubbs, who's now dead, Anglican priest who knew Biko better than any other white person, including Donald Woods. Stubbs says, in introducing one of the two pieces in here that represent speeches that Steve gave to groups of black ministers, that it's very hard for us in a secularized society to appreciate the role that black clergy have as leaders in South Africa. And Biko and his colleagues targeted those black people of influence. And the government gave them the room to do it because they were... Oh, there were black people operating in a black circle to address black thinking, and that's apartheid that the government thought was all right. So Biko, talking to these black ministers, is encouraging them to question, to not mimic everything that they learned in white-led seminaries. The chapter called "The Church as Seen by a Young Layman" is brilliant, which I reread this afternoon, is brilliant for the way in which he argues that whites, he says to these black leaders, what are you doing mimicking, you know, if you really believe in this religion, it's proved adaptable everywhere else. And let me read that one line. It's such a nice, whereas Christianity had gone through rigorous cultural adaptation from ancient Judea through Rome, through London, through Brussels and Lisbon, somehow when it landed in the Cape, it was made to look fairly rigid. This is Biko speaking to black clergy. You know, how come if you've studied the history of Christianity, you know that there's all this cultural evolution, but when it gets to us, it can have nothing to do with African culture. Are you sure? You know. And in another speech to African clergy, he writes, in rejecting Western values, therefore, we're rejecting those things that are not only foreign to us, but that seek to destroy the most cherished of our beliefs as Africans. That the cornerstone of society are people themselves, not just their welfare, not their material well-being, but just people with all their ramifications. We, the Black Consciousness Movement, we reject the power-based society of the Westerner that seems to be ever concerned with perfecting its technological know-how while losing out on their spiritual dimension. We believe that in the long run, the special contribution to the world by Africa will be in this field of human relationship. The great powers of the world may have done wonders in giving the world an industrial and military look, But the great gift still has to come from Africa, giving the world a more human face. And that's what we'll be looking at tomorrow. And his very explicit statements that what was happening between whites and blacks in South Africa was on a parallel with what was happening between the third world in general and the global north, and ask ourselves what relevance that may have for us today as Christians who, in the words of Sunita, try and begin to open ourselves to the word that the churches of the South may want to offer churches of the North. So I have gone an hour, and it is my responsibility to give you a chance to escape. But I'll be around if you have questions.
What year did the apartheid end in South Africa?
Mandela was released in 91, and there's a constitutional convention, and elections are held in 91.